This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, Germany-based American writer and literary phenomenon Nell Zink, on her pair of novels, The Wall Creeper and Mislaid. Today I'm talking to Nell Zink, and at this point normally I read out a little intro blurb, and I've got two today. So Nell Zink was born in 1964 in Southern California and grew up in rural Virginia. She attended Stuart Hall School and the College of William and Mary, where she majored in philosophy. Rather late in life, she got a doctorate in media studies from the University of Tübingen, Germany. She works as a translator, and she lives in Bad Belzig, south of Berlin.
But I don't work as a translator, I'm a writer now.
But also in the past, Nell Zink worked in the construction, pharmaceutical and software industries. And as a writer, she founded an indie rock fanzine in the 1990s. And her work has appeared in various publications, including N Plus One. And she's the author of two recently published novels, The Wall Creeper and Mislaid. And the reason I wanted to read both of those blurbs, the second one from the book, is because they sort of explain quite a lot. They're still quite inadequate in explaining your rather interesting life story.
Does it really say I live in Berlin?
That one does.
In the book?
Zink lives in Berlin.
Oh, I guess I should have proofread that after all.
Oh, yeah, because you don't live in Berlin.
No.
You live south of Berlin.
I live south of Berlin, about an hour south in Bad Belzig.
I think to anyone in England or America, that distinction probably isn't very important.
And maybe I'll make it to Berlin one of these days.
Well, let's talk about how you ended up south of Berlin, first of all. Let's talk about how you got there, and then we'll talk about how you became a writer.
Well, I was first in Germany in 1983, and that's a while ago now, but I went there for no good reason, like after my sophomore year of college in the summertime, and I ended up staying for an extra 6 months or so until like the following March, and learning German. And I kept up with it, simply because there were a lot of German writers I liked. I had learned Spanish in school, but somehow didn't find myself voluntarily reading a lot of Spanish language literature, whereas with German, there was just so much that I liked, you know, this Robert Musil and Kafka and stuff. So I was reading a lot of German in my free time in the US, and then I had made these German friends, so I kept coming back to Germany. And southwestern Germany, nowhere near Berlin. And there was a wall and all that back then. So I, in the year 2000, I was sort of at loose ends, not sure where I wanted to be, and a friend of mine in Germany, in Tübingen, near Stuttgart in the southwest, was just moving out of her room. So I thought, oh, I'll take her room. So I moved there, and not really intending to stay forever, maybe I sort of had a 5-year plan. I thought I would sort of goof off for a year and then maybe look for work, but I ended up goofing off for way more than a year, and eventually, not even looking for work, I just had people realize that I could speak both German and English, and they began to offer me translating jobs. So I ended up staying. And then about a little more than 2 years ago, I moved to northeastern Germany, which is radically different.
And so you were translating. So you were writing to a certain extent.
No. Writing is when you make stuff up.
You were working with words.
Everybody who has the privilege of writing a caption for a picture in the newspaper is way more of a writer than you are as a translator. Mm-hmm. You know, a translator, your job is to conscientiously recreate the work of someone else in a foreign language. It's very, very menial work.
But there was some times where you were, I mentioned the fanzine.
Yeah, it was called Animal Review.
Animal Review.
Yeah, that's ancient history. That was way back in the 90s, that era. Mm-hmm. You may remember.
I do remember the 90s.
Yeah. Okay, that's good.
I wasn't a reader of Animal Review, as it turns out not many people were.
No, it had a circulation of about 80. But, it was 80 of the right people. And I sent it to people who also did fanzines. You make these fanzines to trade for other fanzines and for record labels, so they'll send you records, CDs and singles and LPs and stuff. Back then there wasn't this vinyl craze, so it was mostly CDs and then 45 RPM singles, and then we'd review them.
So at what point did you actually start writing, making stuff up with words?
Well, I had always been doing that, but pretty much in secret. When I started Animal Review as a music fanzine, I started putting a short story in every issue from issue one on. I always would write a little story about an animal, an animal adrift in the human world. I still like those stories a lot. I'm hoping they might be published as a collection someday.
But there's a point where you write a novel. The novel, which is the Hebrew translation.
Oh, yeah. I did sit down in 1998 and write a novel for a friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
I at the time I didn't know him very well, but I liked him a lot. I could tell he was all right. And he had written a novel called Sailing Towards the Sunset, and mm-hmm. I had gone to the awards ceremony where it received a prestigious award for Hebrew literature, and my Hebrew was really weak. It still is. So, like, even the plot summary, I only understood about half of it.
Mm-hmm. So you basically rewrote it.
So I really wanted to read it because such a nice guy had written it, but I couldn't because it was in very high literary Hebrew. So I thought, okay, I'll just write a translation of it for his amusement. I started off just by doing my best to translate the first couple of sentences, mm-hmm. which is just an absolute disaster. And then I went on from there. You know, and when I had 60,000 words, I stopped because that's long enough to be a novel.
But it was basically you completely rewrote the thing. It was a completely different story.
Oh, yeah.
To what?
Because I couldn't even understand the plot summary. And God knows I didn't ask him because he occasionally would tell me if I had gotten something right. Like, I put an albatross in my book and he wrote back and said, "There's an albatross in my book, too." So occasionally there were coincidences. Things would overlap by accident.
But fundamentally, it was about a Selkie. I don't know, a Celtic mythological figure, half seal, half woman.
Well, in the parts of the plot summary that I had understood, it was clear that there was an Israeli spy, a mm-hmm. Mossad agent, who goes to the Shetland Islands and becomes involved with a woman named Mary. That's really all I knew. And so when I thought about the Shetland Islands, I got all mixed up, of course, but I thought, well, maybe they have Selkies there. Maybe Selkies are Irish, I don't know. So so I made her be a Selkie from the Shetland Islands. And she's been out of the water for quite a while because she has this taste for human men, and mm-hmm. she does better with them if she appears to be human. But she keeps her skin close at hand in case she wants to go back into the water. But she really falls hard for this Israeli spy because he's sort of a romantic figure. He's not really devoted to his mission, but he just wants to keep his job, so he goes through the motions.
People might be familiar with the story of Jonathan Franzen's parts in your work getting to publication, which we can talk about in a moment. But that book was the first one you sort of sent to him and he attempted to get published. Is that right?
Well, it's not quite. The truth is so complicated that no one makes sense of it. No matter how many times I tell it to how many people, mm-hmm. no one can get it straight. But I wrote The Wall Creeper. I suppose the first fiction of mine he ever read was about the first third of The Wall Creeper,
mm-hmm.
which I wrote in 4 days and sent to him, mostly as a proof of concept, because he had been getting on my nerves saying, "Why don't you write fiction? Why don't you write fiction? You should try writing some fiction." But he didn't ask to see my fiction. He didn't believe I had any fiction. So I, just to prove the point that I could actually write fiction if mm-hmm. I wanted to, I sat down and wrote the first third of The Wall Creeper in a couple days and sent it to him. And his reaction was very positive, but also very Fransonian. It was like, "This is very accomplished. Tell me if you ever finish it. If it ever mm-hmm. gets to novel length, let me know." So I thought, okay, whatever. And ended up shortly after that finishing it, but I never did send it to him. Mm-hmm. And it was the following summer, after certain other events had transpired, that I sent him, still not Sailing Towards the Sunset, I sent him something else, a novella called European Story for Avner Schatz,
mm-hmm.
also written for Avner.
Yeah, a similar thing.
And the reason I sent him that was because I had written that and deleted it and forgotten all about it and just assumed it was crap. I remembered vaguely. I remembered having written it, but I didn't remember it being good. And then I found a printout of it in my mother's house. She was, in the hospital. And I found her printout of it and I was blown away. It's really, really funny. I love all of them, but European Story for Avner Schatz is extremely funny. I was laughing my ass off. And I was so amused that I asked Avner if he still had a file of it, and he said, "Yes, of course, I saved everything you sent me." So I sent that to Franzen, and a few weeks or a month later, I got back an email from him I mean, we were in touch, but he read this and suddenly he started to respect me, I think, because his response to that manuscript, well, I think when he realized that I wasn't kidding, that I wasn't lying, that mm-hmm. it really was true that I wrote these things that were quite decent, quite publishable, and that I would just delete them and forget about them. I guess he mm-hmm. thought I was kidding. And that's when he said, send me everything you've got. And that's when I sent him Sailing Towards the Sunset by Emmer Schatz, mm-hmm. Which he liked enough to try to get it published.
I'm Emma-Jane Unsworth. Go and read some great new journalism and explore the interview archive at littleatoms.com.
So was that one just more complete, or was it just because he preferred that one?
Well, it's more complete, it's longer, but it's also very... It's sort of sweeter and warmer and more vulnerable, partly because it really was written mm-hmm. as just a series of letters every day.
Yeah.
And it's like 24 letters written in 24 days in December, like an advent calendar. So there's a lot of personal stuff in it, and it's very charming and cute in a way that when I know a bazillion people are going to be reading something, I don't tend, not yet at least, maybe in the last thing I wrote, mm-hmm. but I'm getting more used to the idea of people reading my work, and I'm getting more open and relaxed about it, and mm-hmm. not as scared of people, but there are plenty of reasons to be a little bit cautious and circumspect about what you tell the world.
We'll move on to talk about the two novels. I'm in a similar position to Franson. I've read about a third of The Wall Creeper, but I've read all of Mislaid, so in this interview we'll talk yeah. more about Mislaid. But you just mentioned, first of all, we'll talk about what The Wall Creeper's about first. You mentioned that, you know, you tossed off in 3 days something to send to him.
Yeah.
Something to send to him to prove that you could write. And indeed, that seems to be, throughout reading about your work, a theme that you write very quickly. Let's just talk about that idea, that technique of writing stuff that quickly. You certainly can't tell reading the novel. They don't seem like a, you know, that sort of stream of consciousness, first thing that's come out, put down on paper writing. So how does that work for you, writing at that speed?
I think it works, I guess, either because I'm talented or because I practiced a lot, but or maybe because I don't like suspense.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to keep things fast-paced, keep things moving, because it like bothers me when I'm writing to have some, even a minor climactic event, and write it and wait to write it the next day. It like bugs me. I would rather, you know, resolve the mm-hmm. tension as fast as I can. I don't know. It might be a habit I got into from writing while working as a translator, mm-hmm. because they're always doing project-based work, so that when you do, so that when I had spare time, I never knew when it was going to be over. You know, I would start writing, and at any time a customer could show up and say, oh, translate this unbelievably boring and stupid 80-page document, and I would have to drop everything I was writing and do it, because you can't say no to freelance customers. You know, you'll never see them again yeah. if you say no even once. So maybe it was that time pressure. And unfortunately, there's this analogy arising in my mind to that one thing they say about premature ejaculation in men, is that they'll get trained to it if they have like siblings or parents who spy on them, and so they have to masturbate like really quickly in the bathroom, or like real fast, you know, before they go to sleep or something, and make sure nobody catches them. So then they end up in a sexual situation mm-hmm. with a woman completely trained to come as fast as they can, and that this can be unlearned. You know, I don't want to...
Can you unlearn writing,
you know,
quickly?
I hope no one listens to this podcast, because probably every critic who talks about me for the rest of my life will compare my short novels to premature ejaculation, and there I'll be, but...
Well, to what extent that first third of The Wall Creeper that Jonathan Franzen read, when you tossed it out in 4 days and sent it over to him... How much of that is the same as the third I've read? The published novel, how much of that first draft would survive into the finished novel?
All of it. I don't
all
think I
it.
Changed a single word. And I mm-hmm. don't think Danielle at the Dorothy Project, she had a couple line edits. She did not touch my draft of The Wall Creeper. I mean, they publish very arty stuff, mostly at Dorothea Publishing Project, so that, you know, I'm really relatively coherent and comprehensible.
Mm-hmm.
So she had just about no changes. And that first third, when I was writing the rest, I didn't look at it. I was so ashamed and embarrassed of what I had done that I wrote the rest of the book sort of as penance for trying to show off without looking at it.
But
it was only years later. That's why when I sent it to Dorothea Publishing Project, I was still assuming it was complete unreadable crap, mm-hmm. because I had not read it myself.
You cannot tell, as I've already mentioned, you can't tell reading it that that's the case. And yet there's a prejudice against the idea that you might have written it quickly in that way. But I haven't read the end of The War Creeper.
No,
for all I know, it could go off after that.
To me at this point that if I said I had spent 8 years writing it,
yeah.
people would think it was better.
Which is insane. Which is crazy.
They would think it was better. And I'm trying to establish a new paradigm
mm.
by talking about painters. You know,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, Picasso could sit down and draw a pony and he could do it better than other people because he'd had a lot of practice,
mm-hmm.
right? Okay. So, you know, I've been practicing writing fiction for a long time, so is it any wonder that I can do it in a relatively efficient manner? And you know, God knows, since when am I the only one? I mean, other people, Georges Simenon, he writes faster than I do, or Joyce Carol Oates, I don't really know, but in any case, I think all writers, many writers, write quite fast, and if you press them on it, they'll say, oh yes, I spent 10 years writing this
mm-hmm.
book. But the actual time typing, maybe about 6 months.
So experiences from your whole life go into the book, but that's not, you weren't writing it 15 years ago when similar thing might have happened.
If I had been a novelist, you know, by trade, before The Wall Creeper came out, I could give you a different answer. I could say, well, I began researching The Wall Creeper, which to me is a really ugly idea, the idea that I would go out and meet these conservationists and
mm-hmm.
and talk to bird watchers because I was trying to exploit them to use in a novel, like, ew. But, you know, that's what a novelist
mm-hmm.
does. Like, every new friend you make is like, ooh, material. I'll use you now.
As I said, I haven't finished The War Creeper, but you know, I've read Mislaid and I loved it. I think it's wonderful and it's beautifully written and it's funny.
Did you
and
like the end?
The end, yeah, the end is great. The end
okay.
works really well. It has this, it's sort of a Shakespearean comedy end. And it exists as itself, it's an artifact. And I was reading an interview with you in The Guardian where, profile of you in The Guardian where, you know, the writer of that said, you know, this book's great, but imagine how much better it would have been if you'd have taken more time over it. And I thought,
she thinks I'm a premature ejaculator.
And I thought, that's wrong. It would not be better. It would be different, perhaps.
Yeah.
But it would not be this thing. It would not be this brilliant, perfect thing that exists in its form now.
You know, I think I know what you're talking about, because I do think there are places where a novelist can elaborate, and many novelists elaborate at really punishing length. And I write possibly more like a short story writer,
mm-hmm.
except I do it, you know, for 70,000 words in a row.
Yeah. Yeah, and these,
I should say these
books are quite short.
Economy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, these are not long novels. And at the same time, when I look at other people's long novels, many of them aren't long novels either. They're 80-page novellas stuck together with tape
mm-hmm.
and glue, with 80-page sections. Mine are longer than 80 pages.
Thank you. You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Nell Zink, and we're talking about her novels, The Wall Creeper and Mislaid. And now let's talk about The Wall Creeper for a little, first of all. Tell us what it's about. What's the story of?
Well, The Wall Creeper is about a young woman who just is very bright, but a bit directionless, like many young women. She marries a guy who's a little more purposeful because his secret obsession is birdwatching. And because he is a pharmaceutical researcher, she ends up moving with him to Bern, Switzerland, where they acquire a unique pet called a wall creeper, which is a bird that's a very common bird, but very hard to see because it breeds very high above the tree line in rocky outcroppings or rock faces high in the Alps. But they have one in their home. And, you know, it's hard for me to say what that book is about because you give it a try.
Shall I try and say what it's about, having only read a third of it? Yeah, so Tiffany and Stephen, they live in a flat in Bern. There's various infidelities. There's a long discussion over the merits of anal sex in the first third of the book.
Yeah, she does go a bit of a crusade against anal sex. But as I said, I wrote it for Franzen, and I don't know if you've read Freedom, his book, but there's a place in his heart for anal sex, obviously. And I asked him once, he volunteered the information. I made a joke about it, and he said, "Well, I've had anal sex," and I was like, well, I didn't even want to ask, because if a man says that, he's kind of saying one thing, whereas if a woman says it, mm-hmm. she's saying another.
Yeah.
So we didn't go into detail. But in any case, I just wanted to clear up what I thought were some misconceptions about anal sex. So I admit this, it's a theme in the novel. Okay, these things happen.
The book was originally published under an imprint called Dorothy.
Yes.
Which, as you mentioned in the first half, is like sort of quite avant-garde publication, originally published, I guess, for not very much money. What happened then? I mean, how was that received?
Well,
in the US, it's just coming. I'll just clarify that. We're talking here on the release of both of these novels in the UK, but The Wall Creeper was released last year in the US.
In the US, The Wall Creeper came out last October, mm-hmm. and Mislaid came out this May.
Mm-hmm.
And The Wall Creeper came out from this little tiny press. And it was very well received. It got two reviews in the New York Times, which just was life-changing. You know, that second New York Times review that just catapulted me into the upper echelons of writers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after that, I could kind of throw my weight around. Because if I told people I thought I knew what I was doing, they had to believe me. So it was, it put me in a position of much greater power vis-a-vis my editors and everybody mm-hmm. else. That was very, really nice. And I guess simply because of their connections with the publishing industry, the people who do Dorothy, a publishing project, both have worked in publishing before, but are now employed by a university, and they just wanted to keep their hands in,
mm-hmm.
you know, stay connected with publishing by doing this little sort of hobby-like project with two books a year.
Yeah, but then suddenly there's huge sums of money being bandied about.
Well, huge, it's, you know...
Well, considerably bigger than the first one.
Okay, yes. But I think anybody who dreams of a big advance should dream really big. You know, don't dream of a couple hundred thousand. Dream of millions. That's what fantasy authors get. That's what genre authors get. They get millions. And why? Because the tax man takes half, and they pay it out to you in dribs and drabs over a period of years. So it's kind of just like having a regular middle-class job
mm-hmm.
with a 3 or 4 year contract. It's not wealth. And so if you want to buy a house or a Rolls or something, you're going to have to not only get that advance, but have a huge bestseller.
Mm-hmm.
And then take a big check and just turn around and buy something with it for cash, because you can't get a mortgage with a book deal. You know, it's only income for 2 or 3 years.
But then they're not giving you that massive advance because they're nice. They're obviously anticipating
a
huge bestseller.
I think they're doing it because they're nice. Really, I can't think of any other reason.
Well, I was going to say, you know, one of the things you mentioned previously was, you know, you hadn't necessarily published stuff before for more than an audience of one because you never thought it was any good and thought anybody would want to read it. Then you publish, you know, a novel for a small press, which becomes something of a phenomenon. Now there's a lot of money involved. That obviously puts a lot more pressure on you.
Well, it's pressure, but it's not that bad. Because I mean, I think the publishers, financially, the publisher is out of the woods way before I am.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they advance you X, and you have to earn back X to earn out, as the saying goes. But, you know, so it's like I have to sell, to start getting royalties above and beyond my advance, I have to sell 100,000 books or something. But for them to make money, the number is much smaller. I don't know. I don't want to say how much smaller because I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I don't even know a rule of thumb. Someone said to me, you know, if they advance you 200,000 and sell 100,000 copies involving, including the paperback, they have a profit free and clear of $300,000. But this was the person who told me that was the kind of person who adds 6 and 8 and gets 19. So, you know, I'm really not sure whether it's true. In any case, it's all very mysterious. But you know, publishers stay in business one way or another. And it may be because they subsidize me to some degree, and it may be because they're making money off me. I don't even know, really. I hope they're making money because that's, you know, I want to keep this job.
Let's talk about Mislaid for a bit then. So it's set, or it starts, it goes over a few decades, but it sets in sort of 60s post-segregation rural Virginia, which is where you grew up initially.
Yeah,
so let's talk about what was that place like when you were growing
up?
Well,
it's not post-segregation. You know, segregation was officially over, but, you know, continued under other names.
Mm-hmm.
It officially ended in the 50s, but then, you know, they instituted school voucher programs that you could go to any school you wanted, and, you know, lo and behold, all the black children wanted to go to black schools, and all the white children wanted to go to white schools.
Mm-hmm.
Who knew? And so on. So when I actually moved to Virginia, which is in like 71, as an 8-year-old, integration was relatively fresh and new. And the situation on the ground was that schools had tracking. They had an academic track and a vocational track starting in, you know, pretty early grades. And you would have, in any kind of enrichment program or in the academic track, you would have your token black person. To make the class integrated, you had to have at least one person who was black. But otherwise, it would just be white, all the superior institutions. And the colleges were basically segregated, even in the 80s. So that, like at William & Mary, where I went, there were a few black students, but there was also a partner institution that had been originally founded, I believe, as part of William & Mary, Old Dominion University, and it was basically, it was the black school. That's where black students went. So the situation was not like integration in the rural north, where you had people really in contact with each other.
Mm-hmm.
There was just completely different social spheres, different Masonic lodges, different churches, different everything for black people and white people. So it was, you know, it was more like apartheid.
The book's about, I mean, major theme is identity, and the characters in it,
yeah,
they swap both their sexual and racial identity quite freely.
Yeah.
Both because sometimes they have to, but also just because they feel like it. Well, I'll ask you to say, describe what the book is about, if you can do better than
The Wallcreeper. Sorry about that. It concerns, again, a young woman. Peggy is her name, and she is quite sure that she's a lesbian because of some confusing experiences she's had involving her gym teacher, but that doesn't stop her from getting the hots for a male professor.
Mm-hmm.
So when she goes away to college at a girls' school, where she's gone specifically because it's a heavily lesbian school, she gets sexually obsessed with a male poetry professor who also is generally gay. But since those lines weren't drawn quite so clearly back then, it was quite common for a gay man to have a wife and children,
mm-hmm,
you know, and maybe, you know, meet up with guys at some wayside by the road every Friday or something, or go to a certain bar. But he would have a gay lifestyle. He'd have a perfectly normal straight lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Well, this guy is openly gay. Everybody knows he's gay. And at the same time, his homosexuality isn't something he chose. You know, he was, you know, abused as a child. I made that more explicit in early drafts. My editor wasn't crazy about it, so I took it out. But he's, you know, he might not be as gay as he thinks he is either. So these two people get together, and she gets pregnant. But, you know, socially, Lee Fleming, the poetry professor, has grown up as a gay man, and all his social contacts regard him as gay, and he's in a poetry scene that's heavily gay, mm-hmm. and it's impossible for him to distance himself from that life. So he doesn't really cut her a lot of slack for being a straight woman and boring, and she's very unhappy in this marriage, you know, because they're really, it's not the best marriage. She gets pregnant again, but she, because of her frustration in the marriage, she continues to think she's a lesbian, and, you know, maybe she is a lesbian. It's just hard to tell if you don't actually have sex with anybody what you really are. You know, these are experiences that sometimes have to be tried to be rejected or accepted. So she's kind of trapped there alone, trying to, in a permanent identity crisis. And finally, she just clears out. She wants to take both her kids and leave her husband, but her son is 10 and refuses to go. So she takes her daughter, who's only 2 or 3, and hits the road. And her bright idea of how she can hide from her husband is by crossing the tracks. She'll just, by moving maybe a couple counties over and saying she's black, she'll stop having any social contact with anyone who might know her husband, mm-hmm. period. And that's what she does.
And so she registers, well, she basically steals the, or assumes the identity for her daughter of a dead black child.
Yeah, she figures she'll need a birth certificate to register her daughter for school. So mm-hmm. she goes to the county registrar and says she needs a birth certificate for a little girl named Karen Brown, who she knows is black and has died, and then gives her child this identity.
And yeah, I mean, they're both obviously white people.
Right. That's the thing that, you know, people should be aware of. When I say it, I'm not exaggerating. Mm-hmm. I mean, you, Neil Denny, look, if your hair were maybe a little wavier, maybe if it were longer, you do not really look much different from the first black governor of Virginia, Douglas Wilder. You know, he didn't look Danish. You know, he didn't look like Leif Erikson, but he was black by fiat. Mm-hmm. Because he was from a black family, from a family that had grown up under, that had come up under segregation, subject to all the discrimination and all the exclusion and all the bad treatment black people were subject to. That was his family background, but his appearance didn't tell you he was black. Mm-hmm. He had to communicate this. And so Peggy, the protagonist of Mislaid, she has brown curly hair and brown eyes, so she's really not that far off the blackness spectrum. Her daughter, on the other hand, is really, really pale with, like, silky blonde hair and is also black, which, you know, raises suspicions in people's minds that maybe she's illegitimate or something, but, you know, they don't talk about it. You know, maybe her dad was white, but that doesn't make her any less black. Because if you have a black parent, you were black.
But fundamentally, the thing that makes you black in this situation, similar to, I mean, people in the UK would probably be more familiar with, like, the old apartheid system in South Africa, the fact that you were black because the bureaucracy said you were black.
Right. Well, apartheid was a little different because for people who were, I think, even from, there was one sort of lighter-skinned native tribe that was considered colored. And South Asians were colored, mm-hmm. and if you were mixed, you could be colored. So there was a middle category,
yeah.
Whereas in the segregated South, there were two categories, just two. And there was white, and there was not entirely white. Mm-hmm. So the reality that I was looking back on, relying on when I was writing Mislaid, because I was my memories of really crazy stuff that I thought growing up. For example, I know that I thought I give this line to one of the characters about how maybe French people are black, because I wasn't sure. But the fact was, to me, white people were people who look more or less like me. You know, they're pink, they have light eyes, they have little thin lips and oval faces. And then the first time I went to a foreign film and saw, like, I don't know, Juliette Binoche or something, I thought, is she white? Really? I'm not kidding. I thought, oh, is she, like, one of those hot Creole girls you read about? Because she had, you know, full lips, which was not a white thing. You know, white lips are like George Bush lips. But these are the thoughts of a child and an adolescent. And, you know, I'm sure if you ask even an adult white Southern racist now whether he thinks white people can have full lips, he'll say yes. But I was thinking of my, you know, full lips are very trendy now. But in my childhood, this was, you know, you would look at people and try, just like as though we were looking, you know, when kids will look at a dog and say, oh, I think it's part poodle and part dachshund with a little Doberman pincher. So we were really like little Nazis saying, like, oh, I think she might be part black and part white with a little bit of maybe Russian.
I'm Hannah Fry, you're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
I'm sure it's not the first time this has come up, but, you know, this is quite pressing at the moment because of this Rachel Dolezal.
However you pronounce it, I have no idea.
I have no idea.
I haven't watched any TV about it, so I couldn't tell you.
And
we'll call her Rachel DL.
Yeah. And actually, there's a line that nearly made me drop this book where you actually say, describing various different colours of black people in Virginia in the 1960s, and something like even that, you know, famous case of the chairman of the NAACP.
Yeah, I know,
you actually say that.
Yes.
Well, so this is clearly not something that's a new thing.
No, I was referring to Walter White, who was the NAACP chairman through the mid-50s, from like the 30s to the mid-50s, for a long time, and he was blonde with blue eyes.
Identity, both, you know, both sexual and racial identity at the moment, and particularly in, you know, in an era of social media, which I don't know how sort of au fait you're with, away over there in Germany, away from the, you know, the American literati.
I do, unfortunately, shamefully, have a doctorate in media studies, so, yeah.
So I
know about social media.
So it's interesting to see these. I mean, this is, I think in some respects, the way you describe what the book is about two people of different sexualities stuck in an unhappy marriage, that could make the book sound quite dour. And it's not. It's really funny and rollicking. And it's
she gets out of that marriage pretty fast.
Sure.
That's like on page 4. Well, not quite.
But it was great to see those, like, what are quite, you know, really quite deeply important political themes of people's identities used in just in a really funny comedy. It seemed really refreshing to me.
Well, I think, to me, identity is a heavy theme, partly because I think it gets so tragically overemphasized. You know, human rights are not something that people have given to them as a birthright. They're an abstraction. They're something that as a rational, educated Western, you know, that sounds bad, but it's kind of true. You know, I've talked to many people from other cultures who will say things, oh, yes, I believe in equal rights. All men who are heads of families should be able to vote.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's the idea that we have in Western democracies, that every person has a right, an equal right to participate in how the government is run, is really based on very abstract ideas that are not dependent on how hard this person works to participate, or whether or not they find a way of articulating their ideas, or whether they you know, achieve self-actualization or something. It just has to do with having your voice in a representative government. And I think when I see identity politics at work, it seems to be sometimes distancing itself from that level of abstraction and going down to a sort of tribal, village, anarchist ideal that we're you know, I'm going to find my tribe, find people who are just like me, and we're going to work together to have the kind of society we want in our little neighborhood or our little house, you know, basically our little ghetto, you know, for better or worse. You know, it's nice to be surrounded by people who are just like you, but but it puts distance between you and that all-important abstraction, which is to say, I am not like other people, but there are certain rights that they should enjoy just as I do, and we can negotiate as a society what those rights are. So in the book, I suppose I do put in a sort of implicit argument against identity politics, because identity can be so malleable, whereas the individual human being and its need to be free, his or her, you know, no, I guess its is better, right? In the age of identity.
Yeah, in this context.
You know, in this context.
I'm going to get you to read a bit of one of the books, but before we do that, just one more thing from me. I mean, I've mentioned that, I don't know how deliberate this was, but it does, you know, mislaid does have this feel of a Shakespearean comedy, you know, mistaken identity as a brother and sister, separated, and then, you know,
yeah,
coming together and reunited.
Yeah.
But this also reads like nothing else, you know, like something from left field, something else that I've doesn't seem familiar. And I wondered what other writers, if any, influenced it. What sort of things do you read?
You know, in structuring Mislaid the way I did, this is going to sound really pretentious, but I was thinking of books at all. I was thinking of music. And maybe because I've just spent so much time hanging around composers, and I don't even know what it's called in English, so not in Hauptsatz form, the structure of a symphony or of a sonata where you establish a theme and then, you know, you have your scherzo, and then you put in a false climax, and then a real one later on. And so I was thinking very formalistically when I decided what my story was going to be. I wanted, on a very abstract level, to have these two strands that separate and then come together in a sort of chaotic conflagration. And when I, you know, my conscious models, seriously, were like Der Rosenkavalier. I was thinking of like operetta. And I, you know, I think that comes across, and I, so that possibly it's, this is going to sound even worse, it's maybe slightly more sophisticated readers are going to enjoy it more simple, or people who have that sort of slightly old-fashioned cultural consumption habits, who have seen The Magic Flute and enjoyed it, are going to be more entertained by the way this novel ends than someone who's simply expecting it. You know, as my editors kept saying, you know, where's the scene where Lee gets killed in revenge? And I was like, excuse me, but this is a happy book. This is not a book that's supposed to, you know, I already wrote a book that starts with a car crash, and I was
there is a miscarriage, crash is done in one line as well.
Yeah, but I mean, I was being very perverse and rebellious, I suppose, because when I wrote The Wall Creeper, I was writing it for Franson to show that I knew how to write accomplished fiction, you know. So I used all the really simple sort of micro-formal devices that you can use to make people look at your book and not turn their eyes away, like violence, you know, explicit sex, very explicit sex. You know, I did that for him to amuse him, but when I sat down to write a book for the general public, I very perversely refused to give them that. Mm-hmm. There's no violence. Is there any violence in Mislaid?
She drives a car into a lake. It's not violence.
Well, no, there's nobody. She takes the kids out of the car first, and
gets them to watch it.
Gets them to watch
there's,
it.
There's some explicit sex.
The lake's
sex.
Not very deep. Well, there's
a little bit.
Maybe, but not terribly.
Not the same as the Wall Creeper.
And then there's
And yeah, it has a happy, yeah, it ends happily. We shouldn't really talk about it.
Yeah, there's one guy who dies.
And there's a dead baby.
There's a dead baby?
Yeah, Karen. The original Karen Brown.
Oh, yeah, the original Karen Brown. Well, we don't meet her. So I try to take this... I take a happy story and tell it against the background of a perverse, cruel, racist society that is constantly putting everyone who is identified as black into untenable positions and making their lives impossible.
Listening to Little Atoms, I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Nell Zink, and we're talking about her novels The Wall Creeper and Mislaid.
This is just a scene from the middle, right in the middle of the book, when Lee Fleming, the poetry professor, meets his old friend Carrie for dinner, and they reminisce about the good old days. Lee met Carrie for dinner at the Yacht Club in Norfolk. They sat opposite each other at a square table decked with several layers of linen and picked at softshell crabs. 2 points abaft the port beam, Lee said. Carrie turned to the left and looked over his shoulder. Swish, he said. Those slacks make her look like Quentin Crisp. The object of their attention was a well-built young man wearing a blue blazer and dove gray pleated front gabardine pants. He took no notice of Lee and Carrie, but pulled out a chair for his dinner date, a man in a seersucker suit whose forelock had been bleached in cellophane such a shiny peach shade that it put Carrie in mind of daylilies, as he said immediately. He and Lee were wearing the clone look, white Oxford cloth button-downs with distressed jeans and white Reeboks, because they wanted to go dancing later on at one of those new non-underground, as in highly conspicuous, with neon and a line out the door, discotheques where they play sped-up music and feature drag queens so tall and square-jawed they couldn't live as women and had to spend their lives on the run, a.k.a. on tour. Actually, Carrie was somewhat shy of the mark, with red-soled white bucks on his feet, but his jeans were more distressed than Lee's. Carrie had read and reread the jeans distressing tutorial in The Joy of Gay Sex, struggling to make sense of new tricks demands on old dogs, Lee's line. His first pair was a total loss, too much bleach. The second pair came out soft and robin's egg blue, but he ruined them during the lay them out in the driveway and run over them a couple times stage. Maybe the guys in the book had flat driveways made of concrete and not rippled heaps of oyster shells? The guys all look kind of urban in the drawings. The third pair came out just right. Carrie himself wasn't quite right. Soft in the middle, with stubble hiding in folds in his face he was too lazy to shave. But you couldn't really fault him for not trying. Lee had the look down cold, but he, too, was getting old for it. His hair was thinning on top and had to be fluffed with mousse. They stirred their drinks in silence, watching the younger men. Où sont les neiges d'antan? Lee asked. They should build a monument, Carrie said. All the times I got my ass beat to a pulp so the youth of today could get dolled up like faggots to go out in public. They ought to come over here and kiss your hand. Suddenly, unexpectedly, two women in little black dresses and eye-catching funky accessories entered the room and approached the young men. The men jumped up and kissed them on alternate cheeks, European style. Their collective fluttering wafted odors of Antaeus and Eau Sauvage all the way to Lee and Carrie's table. After securing the attention of the entire room, the two couples sat down again. It was unmistakable. They were straight, all four of them. And the misfits who had shown America the way to flamboyant self-promotion, originally as a way of finding comfort in one another's brashness as they cowered in basements, fearing for their lives, sat nipping scotch in identical shirts and 501s, drilled to conformity and finding scant comfort in other people's flouting it. Lee sighed and lowered his voice. Carrie, are you wearing eyeliner? You are not getting a rise out of me. I cannot abide teasing. God, I feel like a Romanov, Lee said. Deposed monarch of the ancien regime, awaiting execution. Welcome to the No South. You mean New South. I mean No South. You can't have New and South. It's oxymoronic. I'm talking about the No South, the unstoppable force that's putting in central air everywhere until you don't know whether it's day or night. Fat boys used to spend their lives in bed and only come out to fish and hunt. Now they go into politics and make our lives hell. One little thing, all by itself. AC made the South go away overnight. Very astute, Lee said. Claude Levi-Strauss. Sad subtropics. Freaks everywhere, Carrie added, glancing at the two handsome young couples. Look at those driving moccasins he's got on, with nipples on the soles. Looks like a chew toy. And somebody should tell his lady friend, black is what a Moldavian fortune teller wears, and pink stilettos is 12-year-old streetwalkers. Did you know they had to start up valet parking because of all the women who come in here literally unable to walk? All my life, this club's had a no-pimp rule. They watched the two couples for a bit, Carrie said. Well, your life is ended, they ate. Lee said, you remember how we used to get up at night when it was too hot to sleep? Slip out and swim off a canoe. I remember. We never slept in summer. We must have slept. What for? Did we do anything during the day? Mais oui, mon frère, you haven't had a day off since 1954. It's just that your vocation isn't always what you or anybody else would call work. Lee considered how much socializing he had managed to pass off either as poetry or cultivating Stillwater's endowment and said, true enough. Now here in climate control, we got a work ethic, Carrie said. We don't tolerate your kind of sinecure. We're upwardly mobile social climbers with unequal unemployment, lack of opportunity. Pains me greatly that I never noted your poetic gifts. I would have solicited some pieces. Let me explain. Say 10 years ago you go to rent a truck. You go into the rental place and how many guys work there? Doesn't work? You know what I mean. There's a guy behind the counter, his dad in the garage. And 4 or 5 boys hanging in the parking lot, and you say, that's the truck I want, and the boys get on it, and his mom does the paperwork, and 5 minutes later, you got your truck. So what we got now? You got the white guy. He owns a franchise for 3 counties because he's the only one who can get credit. The truck is disgusting. You wouldn't haul a hog in it to slaughter. There's no gas in the tank, and it won't shift out a second, and he tells you to call the toll-free number for service, and nobody works there. Not one person. The poor capitalist fucker is there all on his lonesome, raking it in for some chain. And that's what I call unequal unemployment, lack of opportunity. The South was built on the cheap labor of neighbors. No immigration, no out-migration, no upward mobility, no downward mobility. Land rich, dirt poor, don't matter. Land and dirt are the same damn thing. The rich man charges rent to live on it. The poor man charges wages to work on it. It's the circle of life. Now they're making money off borrowed money from banks that cross state lines. That's squeezing the life out of us. So, do we deserve better? You're the one who's supposed to care the world is going to hell. You have a son. What's he got to do with it? Damn it, Lee, you bullshitted your way into the last of the bullshit jobs. What's Bertie gonna do, manage a sawmill? Don't knock my sawmill. He spent last summer working construction. Carrie laughed and Lee added, he'll be off my hands soon. He's at a big public university, mixing and mingling. That's what they go to school for now. He wants to work. Nobody wants to be a white supremacist anymore. Says you, here. Carrie glanced around to indicate their surroundings and an elderly black waiter stepped up. He shook his head and the waiter moved back to the wall. Listen, Bertie is from the next world, the air-conditioned world to come. He doesn't care where you're from, who your daddy is, or anything about you except how you fit into his master plan. He treats me like a stranger. He engages me in conversation about public policy. I tell him he's my son, not my congressman, but we talk on a level of intimacy I would expect from a casual fuck in an elevator. He worships me from afar. He's just not sure how far is far enough. Did I tell you he wrote me an animal rights protest song? He did what? My son composed, in my honor, a folk song about a horse's right to run on a bank track. It spares their fetlocks from strain. You are shitting me. Cross my heart, he wrote a traditional American ballad of mourning for a 3-year-old that died of a broken ankle a very short time after it was shot. While Carrie wiped his eyes, Lee went on, lowering his voice even more. He played it to me on the baritone ukulele. And he dedicates this song to me whenever he sings it in public. My son, Bird Fleming, expressing his love for me in song. Now tell me chivalry ain't dead. Shit, man, what did you do? Does it matter? I want to be like my wild, free young son, a handsome student with my whole life ahead of me, and do however I feel and not give a shit what anybody thinks and be high as a kite every damn day. Carrie reached for Lee's drink and said, you're too skinny to be ordering doubles. You know what? It's time I went for a swim. Lee stood up. I need to cool off. With you all wet, they're not going to let us in the club. Fuck the club. I don't need to rub shoulders with a bunch of no-name hard bodies who think I'm Death in Venice warmed over. It upsets me every time. I can't dance to their music, Carrie assented. It leaves me deaf. Jellyfish in the meat market. Lee said. He took off his watch. It was waterproof to 30 meters, but attached to his wrist with orange and navy grosgrain ribbon, and laid the contents of his pockets on the table. He walked out the French doors to poolside, leaving them open. Wearing his sneakers, and rather hoping they would be ruined, he climbed the ladder to the low springboard, smoothing his hairdo with a rueful expression as though bidding it goodbye, and bounced into the backlit water. Carrie copied his cannonball with better success. After just a few minutes, the pool was full. The couples who had provoked their profound moral crisis sashayed to the pool, giggling, and pushed each other in. The women shrieked, lost their shoes, swam in their dresses, die-running, lace-ripping, feigning modesty, wet sari style, as they climbed the stairs with their wrists crossed between their boobs. The tidily shaved men swam a bit in shirts and slacks, then cavorted in patterned synthetic briefs and amulets on leather thongs. The sun went down and the whole club drifted outside. A waiter served drinks and turned up the music. The younger people played in the pool or sat on the edge, dangling their feet in the water. Carrie and Lee had about all the fun they could handle, which wasn't much. Wriggling on a lounger in tight, wet denim will make you miss mattress and khakis and wet boxers. No. Then it was late, and they headed home to sleep while they were both still able to drive to their own satisfaction. They couldn't go to the cockpit. It was closed. It had never been an underground club. It had a liquor's license and a sprinkler system and clean sanitary facilities. The authorities tolerated it. Hardly anybody knew about it. Then it made the paper in a celebratory article by a well-meaning journalist. He thought hundreds of happy men dancing unmolested to a jukebox in a crowded bar was a sign of gay liberation, which he strongly supported. The name alone. Cockpit. Naval Air Station or no Naval Air Station, it had to go. Public pressure shuttered it overnight for zoning violations. So many men, so little parking.
It's closed down because somebody writes about it.
No, that's a real experience I had.
That's a real true story.
Yeah. There was a gay disco in Lewisburg called the Rainbow's End, and this idiot, Jack Priest, from the Virginia Gazette, decided that a big gay disco in a basement in Williamsburg, Virginia, that drew men from as far away as Washington, D.C., you know, this cult disco where he thought that was such a wonderful thing, he should praise it in his weekly column in the paper.
Got it closed down.
And the next day it was gone.
I've been talking to Nell Zink, and we've been talking about her novels, The Wall Creeper and Mislaid. So, Nell, thank you very much for coming in and telling me about them.
Well, you're welcome. It was nice. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
The show is supported by 89 Up and hosted by Positive Internet. You can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
You can find old interviews, new journalism, and more on our relaunched website, littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.